What I would do is I would go to the pool. Back in the old days, there was no therapy. We didn't, you know, there wasn't the focus on mental health. And so I would go to the pool and I would try to hurt myself as much as I could physically. Not in a bad way. I would train as hard as I could to induce as much pain, because the more physical pain that I had, the less emotional pain that I had.
Yeah.
It became kind of a trait that I would just go and work really, really hard. Improvement happened very quickly after that. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I did win the state championship for Kyle. I set a national record, the fastest high school breaststroker in history. The state record in Ohio stood for 20 years, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
And I had so over-prepared for the high school state meet that I ended up making the Olympic team.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a coach and speaker. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. On this episode, I interview Glenn Mills. In 1980, won the 200-meter breaststroke at the 1980 U.S. Olympic Trials, making the Olympic team, received the Congressional Gold Medal in 1980, NCAA champion in 83, founded a huge and very successful platform called Go Swim TV with Barbara Hummel, the official technique video supplier of USA Swimming and the American Swim Coaches Association. Sparrow has a Paragon Award from the International Swimming Hall of Fame. Glenn has an incredible story of perseverance and overcoming. Believing at a young age he was not a good swimmer, but then something tragic occurs in his family, and he uses that to fuel his Olympic dream. A moving and very insightful story. So glad he shared that with us. It's very interesting also how he deals with the boycott of the 1980 Olympics and sees some parallels today with the 2020 Tokyo Olympics being postponed. Great, amazing, rich stories. A terrific example of perseverance and using hardship to achieve his dreams. So grateful for his time and stories. I hope you enjoy this interview. Glenn Mills, how are you today?
Good. Thanks, Darwin. Thanks for the great intro and wonderful to be here.
So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your career, kind of in your own words.
You know, growing up as an athlete and a swimmer, I was very committed to making sure that I did something else with my life. So when I got out of college, I probably had 10 to 15 different jobs in trying everything. And the one thing that solidified my life or kind of brought things back together was I would do clinics for kids. I would go out to teams and I would just talk to teams and talk to kids. And so it was, swimming was one of those things that gave me a nice platform or a base. There was a level of comfort. And what I realized is that I started to help people and I really enjoyed helping people. So it always kind of drew me back in until finally I realized that this is pretty much what I was meant to do. I think I saw coaching and swimming and teaching as something less than I should be. It seemed like, you know, I should do something greater with my life. Mm-hmm. What that was, I had no idea. And as it turns out that it really was what I was meant to do. And I've enjoyed it ever since and helped a lot of people and they've helped me along the way as well.
One of the most interesting things about your story relates to how you kind of got started really into becoming a competitive swimmer and relates to your older brother. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can take us through that and we can explore that a little bit, because it seems like it was very formative in your growth as a person. Really.
Yeah, it really defined me. As a young kid, I wasn't fast. I wasn't a good athlete, but I had two older brothers that were very good. And I kind of would go to the pool starting at 5 years old just to be around them. And I became more like the team mascot. I probably at 12 or 13 years old was the time I got my first award. I was not a good swimmer. And about 14 years old, my middle brother, Kyle, had lost his leg to bone cancer. Now, we were all breaststrokers in the family, and breaststroke is very difficult to swim with one leg.
Yeah.
So my oldest brother, Kevin, had already won the Ohio High School State Championship, and we figured Kyle would be next, and then, you know, and that would be it, because there was no chance that I was ever going to win it.
Yeah.
So after Kyle lost his leg, I had gone to him and said that I would win the high school state championship for him someday. And, you know, he thanked me and, you know, he helped me work on some technical stuff over the next year. And it was about a year later that he died. So the cancer had gone through his entire body. And I got to witness, the process of how it takes its course. And it's very destructive. So it was from that moment. I remember Kyle died on a Thursday, and on Friday I went to practice. I always swam in lane 5, and the pool went from lane 1 to lane 6, the slowest to the fastest. And at this point I was in lane 5. I showed up on Friday, and of course everybody knew and everybody was quiet. And I stood behind lane 6. Nobody said anything. And so I just went right to the fastest lane in the pool. And from that day forward, I was committed to accomplishing that goal, to honor that goal that I had set out for my brother. So what I would do is I would go to the pool. Back in the old days, there was no therapy. There wasn't the focus on mental health. And so I would go to the pool and I would try to hurt myself as much as I could physically, not in a bad way. I would train as hard as I could to induce as much pain, because the more physical pain that I had, the less emotional pain that I had.
Yeah.
And it became kind of a trait that I would just go and work really, really hard. Improvement happened very quickly after that. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I did win the state championship for Kyle. I set a national record, the fastest high school breaststroker in history. The state record in Ohio stood for 20 years, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
And I had so overprepared for the high school state meet that I ended up making the Olympic team. And so that was in 1980. So I was still a senior in high school when I made the Olympic team. But that showed me that there's so much more inside of everyone, that we don't know who we can be until we've made the decision that we're going to put everything into this task or this goal. And if you completely 100% commit yourself to something, all aspects of your life to that specific goal, you're probably going to do better than you thought you could. And so that has been what has shaped me ever since, is that if I'm going to do something, I want to do it as well as possible. And that's, I try to do that with everything. I fail more often than not because, I don't have that focus and that drive most of the time on the small details in life, but hopefully the business speaks for itself at 20 years old now. So we're very committed to what we do, but it's every day, as you know.
Thanks. And we certainly will get to GoSwim.tv, but thanks for sharing that. And it's admirable that you found a way to turn something so tragic into something so positive. And one of the things that's fascinating about that story is that it kind of became the spark that triggered excellence and greatness in your life. And yet you weren't the most talented person, and you're saying some of the early signs were that you weren't, winning earlier as you started as a swimmer. And so you've worked with many, many high level, many, many Olympians, world champions, gold medalists. What are some of the traits that you've witnessed amongst those that are really elite, truly elite?
There's a consistent focus toward the end result. And each day is a piece of the process, that there's a patience about the process and a consistency to the process. It's everything from how many strokes you take per length. The best athletes will be able to tell you exactly how many strokes they'll take. They know what their stroke rate is. It's studied. There is no such thing as luck in athletics. And so there has to be the science behind it. There has to be the process of, every aspect that you're going to in order to be the best. And this is something that I talk to especially kids about quite frequently. Mm-hmm. They bring up the word best, And I have to remind them there is only one. And we've kind of muddied down this this best into believing that everybody's the best. And it's unfortunate. But when you get to that level, the Olympic level, there's only one best. And if that's what your goal is, you have to have this all-consuming, well, I take that back. It's not all-consuming. It's all-consuming during the process. Right. There will be times that you have to get away from it or else it'll drive you crazy.
Right, right.
So, but it is the daily grind, as they say, and you have to be committed to the process. And that was one of the things that kind of ties into this. When I went to college, as an Olympian, but as a kind of a deflated Olympian, my dad gave me a sign that I hung in my room at college, and it was a quote by Jesse Owens. And Jesse Owens said and reminded us all, it's not the Olympics that make the Olympian, it's the preparation. So everything is about the preparation. It's not about that day, it's about the years before it. And that's what the great athletes understand.
That's reflective of your Michelangelo quote as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the work you put in, and it seems like wonderful and easy.
It's funny, I had a conversation with one of my former athletes yesterday that is a naval helicopter pilot. And in our conversation, he brought up the word lucky. And I wrote back to him and I said, you of all people would know there is no such thing as luck. And he wrote back, he said, it's funny how people look at me now. They say, you get to fly helicopters, that's lucky. He said, yeah, it was lucky that I spent 4 years doing this and 8 years doing this. And he said, it's not luck. It's all about the process.
Yeah. As I interact with, you know, more athletes and coaches, and especially high level, like yourself, there's often a talk about the dynamic between process and outcome. And I'm wondering if you can take us through what the word process means to you.
Well, especially now as a, I consider myself more as a teacher than I do as a coach.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to instill in someone the process of building their stroke, of building their technique, of building themselves as an athlete. And so they have to understand that some of the most basic foundationary principles that everybody likes to get by, just basic balance in the water, how your body interacts with the water, depending on its density, depending on your bone structure, depending on just nature itself. You have to first discover the simplest aspects of it and hone that so that any movement you make is productive. So we go back to the absolute basics to rebuild every swimmer that we work with to say, okay, how does your body interact with the water? Where is it the heaviest? Where is it the lightest? How do we interact from pressure points and rotation to get you into a position that allows you to move forward with as little effort as possible? From there, then we start to build force application, what muscles they're using in order to engage the water, how does that impact or not impact the way that their body is then traveling through the water? Because swimming is as much or more about minimizing drag or resistance than it is about producing force. So the process in our sport is so incredibly detailed, and it's different for every individual on the face of the planet.
You've worked with numerous, you know, exceptional individuals, and you've talked about Jeff Rouse, Aaron Pearsall, both being world record holders, and the way that they swim, interestingly, is quite different. And yet you're trying to find commonalities, kind of universal commonalities, universal in quotes, that apply, you know, for example, what we talk about with reducing, you know, drag. So how do you balance then the individual traits and, you know, those unique ways of doing things by someone, and balanced with some of these universal commonalities that you might find?
So it's very interesting, especially working with a lot more triathletes now, as I work with the ASU women's team and USA Triathlon Project Podium. I have a lot more triathletes that come here that aren't necessarily natural swimmers. And the body type is so different that if I had a set number of things that I would say, you have to accomplish these things. If I have a normal human coming in here, and again, a normal human that's not one of these high-level Olympic athletes, they're going to have things that they don't understand, and maybe their goals aren't that lofty, you know, to make the Olympics, because maybe they're a little older at this point. we have to take the combination of what their body brings to the sport. Okay. Are they dense? Are their legs heavy? Do they not have balance? And combine that with what do they do for enjoyment? If we get so much to the point where we say, I'm only going to teach you if you will spend the time to have the perfect stroke. And if their physiology doesn't allow them to ever reach that point, all I have is a consistent, unhappy customer. So you have to make adaptations on technique based on the individual, what their goals are, what their age is, and you know how they want to, how serious they are about this particular sport. So you're not only taking the physiological, you're taking the psychological, you're taking the ambition, everything. It's not just about how to swim. It's about how to make somebody happy. And if you make somebody happy because you've taught them something they didn't think they could do and they made them a little bit better, then you're accomplishing so much more than just teaching somebody how to swim. So it's that's what, again, I love what I do because every person that comes in here is different from that standpoint. All the way down to the 12-year-old kids that come in. I had a 7-year-old recently that came in and got to work with him and his parents about how to go back to their state and where do they go from here, knowing the process is this kid will not reach his physical potential for 20 years. And if they try to speed up that process, they'll miss it.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the anxiety of performance will mean the limitation of performance.
And I understand better now why you might consider yourself a teacher as opposed to a coach per se. And there's an interesting quote from you, which says, "It often got to the point where when I stopped the motor, the swimmer would immediately stand up, smile, and say, 'I know, I know.'" And it seems to me that as you've worked and you're really working and developing with people, they kind of reach like a level of self-awareness. And it seems like that is inherent in the way that you choose to coach, not coach, but teach, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the whole process is not for me to tell them how much I know. The whole process is for them to understand what they do so that when they go off on themselves, by themselves, they understand when they've made a mistake or when they've done something well. Because they're only going to spend a short amount of time with me. If I don't teach them what's right, what's wrong, and how to identify that, then you become a crutch as a coach. My wife, Rachel, and I always talk about creating independent athletes, that if you have a high-level athlete that is at a very important competition and you're both supposed to meet at the pool on that given moment, and let's say you have a flat tire or you miss your plane or your bus or something goes wrong, what's that athlete going to do? Everything has to be experienced and understood, and it has to be a process that if you don't show up there, it doesn't impact the athlete other for them being a little bit sad that you didn't get to share that moment with them. But you have to educate and build awareness within everyone you work with about how to take care of themselves. And if they become independent, they become better.
That's fascinating. And when you've approached Olympians and talking with Olympians, it might be harder to say you'd go faster if you did this. And so there's a certain maybe care in the way you might approach. And so you have a fascinating approach in working with Olympians, you know, elite swimmers, where you might not coach per se, where, you know, do this and don't do that. You say rather, why do you do this and why do you do that? And I'm wondering if you can take us through that. That in and of itself is, you know, like a self-awareness question.
So this is something that we post a video every day to Instagram and Facebook. We give away a free video to hundreds of thousands of people every day. And I'll post 10 to 15 seconds of something. And the video might be 3-4 minutes long. And this is what gets frustrating to me, is that people watch the 10 to 15 seconds and they'll say, well, this is wrong. But you have to watch the whole thing. I might be posting something specifically to throw you off. And I'm going to support those people that take the extra step and go and watch the full video. I think education has got to be much, much broader than what's shown on Instagram. So when I work with an Olympian, I'm there to learn because they didn't become an Olympian by just going and signing a form. They became an Olympian because they went through the entire process of life with unbelievable coaches that are all incredibly talented to get someone to that level. So who am I to come in from the outside and say, you should do this instead of that? Because that assumes that neither the Olympian nor their coach or coaches that they've had in the process didn't think of that already. So I'm saying I'm smarter than these people because I'm going to tell you to do this. They might turn right around and say, look, we tried that 4 years ago. It doesn't work for me. And so now you want me to go back in the process. I think I was happiest in the one reaction. We were here before Rachel started working for Bob Bowman at ASU. We were on our 16-month around-the-country trip.
And this is your wife, Rachel, who coaches.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she coaches with Bob Bowman.
And Bob Bowman, and so, Michael Phelps' coach, right?
Michael Phelps' coach. So we stopped here at ASU. Bob invited us. And as soon as I walked on deck, Bob comes over and he says, are you ready? I said, for what? He says, well, you got to start filming these guys. So he sent me to the other pool. And one of the first swimmers he sends me is Allison Schmidt, 8-time Olympic medalist.
Yeah.
So Allison comes over and I'm filming Allison. And my job at that point as a videographer was to provide Bob with better video so that he could see finer details on his swimmers.
Okay.
It wasn't as a technician. Okay. This was 3 months before Rio. Okay. That we were.
Wow.
That we visited ASU. So 3 months before the Rio Olympics. And I'm filming Allison Schmidt, and Allison stops, and she stops, and she looks at me, and she says, how's my head position? And I went, and it finally hit me. I said, there is no way I'm telling you anything about your stroke, because I would be the guy that messed her up by giving her advice right before Olympic trials.
I see, yeah, right.
So, and
well, this is before, right before trials, even.
Right before trials, yeah, because she hadn't made the team in 16 yet. The end of our trip was Olympic trials. But she stopped, she stood up, she goes, oh my gosh, no one has ever not given me advice before.
What?
And yeah, everybody wants to be the person that saves that person. I knew that I could have been the person that destroyed the person had I said the wrong thing. Now, Allison lives 2 blocks away now, comes over quite frequently, and we're all good friends. Now, had I gone a different route, messed her up, you know. So the interesting thing about that is that I was done filming, I thought, and I was walking away and Bob's walking toward me and he stops me and he says, now, you know, this is just for the team, right? This is just for us. I said, yeah, I'm just filming this for you. I'll give you all the footage afterwards. And I turn around and I see Michael climbing out of the pool. And I said, oh, okay.
Michael Phelps. Yeah,
Michael Phelps. So Michael's climbing out of the pool, which then I knew I'm going to film Michael and he wants to make sure I'm not going to go put it on the internet somewhere. Now we've known each other. We've known each other a long time, so he trusts me. So this was the most fascinating thing to me. I filmed Michael more than any athlete the entire trip. We filmed him from above, from the side, from the front. And each time the three of us would get to the end of the length and Bob and Michael would say, what do you see? And so we would look at the video and I would say, you know, this is what I noticed. They weren't asking me because, oh, here's this, you know, this great guy. They sought anything from anyone that could potentially make him a little faster. They were so open to suggestions because they might have overlooked something that somebody else might see. And so it was one of the most fascinating things that here was the greatest swimmer in the history of the world asking, what do you see? Because he wanted to know if there was something that he was doing right or wrong, or maybe from a different angle that he hadn't seen before. And again, this is the most videoed man in the history of the world, as far as swimming is concerned. So it was great. We're all, fortunately, whatever I said or didn't say, didn't mess him up. Okay. And we're all still friends. That's the way I see it, is that you're much greater danger of messing someone like that up than you are in helping them. So Bob and Michael, they did it all. So it was great.
What goes through your mind the moment, you know, Allison asks you that and Michael and Bob are asking you this? What goes through your mind in that the first moment, the first time?
Incredibly reflective.
Yeah.
You don't just spit something out. Mm-hmm. You have to think, what could I say that would be taken the wrong way? And so you don't just rush to what you're going to say, because it has to be very clear, has to be very concise, and it has to make sense. From a biomechanical standpoint, it better make sense, because if it doesn't, then they just know you're a wacko anyway. So you have to think before you speak. And this is certainly something that we learned on the trip visiting 80 teams, is that sometimes people talk to make sure that they're being heard rather than saying something with purpose and meaning. And I could be doing that right now, but
no, this is fascinating. Please talk. <Okay. laughs> If I can apply kind of the why statement, we might think of it as start with why, the Simon Sinek idea. Why do you do what you do now? And I'll flash up the Go Swim screen here as we talk.
The whole thing actually started way back with my brother, in that I found inspiration and motivation in something that was external to the sport. What I try to do with Go Swim is be a piece of the process for kids that can be better than what they thought they could be if they add some study to it. If they spend some time outside of the pool, learning how the body works, learning better techniques. So we've been a very giving company, in my opinion, for a long, long time. But the idea that we share a video every day to hundreds of thousands of people makes me feel good. And obviously, as a business, it's the freemium model that we're going to show you the video that we think is important that day. Mm-hmm. If you want to see more, then you have to pay. Mm-hmm. So it's the combination between the two that keeps us going. That's the online portion of it. The reason that Rachel and I spent so much money on putting a pool in our backyard and covering it so that it's shaded is because online is one thing. And we all know much more about online education now since COVID-19. There's a loss of humanity. There's a loss of connection. And so the idea that I'm going to go in the backyard and help somebody is something that I make that personal connection with someone. I can see the look on their face when I tell them something that makes it better. Without that, it's very difficult to even produce the videos that I produce because it could just be out of theory. In the backyard, it's practical application. Are the things that I teach in mass functional in person? So the combination between the two, it's fantastic right now. I've feel very fulfilled in so many ways because now I have them both, the personal and the kind of the mass teaching as well.
That's fascinating. And clearly you've thought about this because I can hear it in your voice and your way of being as you're speaking. It's quite inspiring. Now, then it seems like you found, you know, your purpose and what really fulfills you. If we can go back in time when you made the Olympic team and then the US boycotts, and there's a hilarious quote, I hope it's funny to you, where you sometimes tell people you finish sixth to minimize the number of questions you get. How did that feel then? That I imagine would have been, you know, like a major goal for you, and then not to be able to get there for something completely out of your control. Mm-hmm. How do you process that moment?
The reason I do that is because sixth is just good enough to get respect, but not so good they'll go and check. And so the reason that story has come up is because since 1980, over the last 40 years, I have answered the "what place did you get" so many times that I get tired of it. And it's to the point where, you know, I don't like talking about it that much, like out just on the street or anything like that. But so in 1980, I was 18 years old. I was improving every year. I was getting faster. I was the fastest guy in the United States. I was one of the fastest guys in the world.
Yeah.
You just figure that will just continue. You just keep getting faster and faster through college. And then so I just figured after 80, well, I'll just make 84. I made world championship team. I won NCAAs the year before Olympic trials. And it just didn't work out. And so it wasn't until 84 that I really felt the loss, because I knew it was over. You know, at 22 years old, I was done with the sport because we couldn't earn any money. There was no professional swimming. We were actually forbidden from, like, I couldn't coach and compete because that would be making money on my profession or my sport.
The amateur rules.
The amateur rules.
Okay.
So at 22, you were done. But we know now you're not even done maturing. You got many more years that you can swim.
Yeah. Okay.
So So that was really the, it was in 84 that I felt the sense of loss. And you kind of learn to deal with that process, but every once in a while, something else comes up. I think 2 years ago, the Olympic movement came out with what's called OLY, O-L-Y, which is a suffix at the end of the name that you can put if you're an Olympian. And a friend of mine had, another 1980 Olympian had applied for it, and the Olympic Committee came back and said, no, you can't use it because you didn't actually compete. So I totally get it,
man. Okay.
I saved myself from applying for it and having been embarrassed of them telling me that you're not really an Olympian. Cause that's the big process with all of us is that are we or aren't we? The International Olympic Committee says we're not. The US Olympic Committee feels guilty. So they say we are. So we're kind of in the middle of no man's land. So, you know, this being the 40th anniversary of it, is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about it. And at the same time with COVID, you know, people are drawing comparisons between not going in 80 and then these athletes not being able to go now. And the hurt and the pain for the athletes is the same. The reasoning are completely different. But, you know, we feel horrible for the athletes and we're trying our best to give them all hope that this is a positive for 2021. You have to turn everything into a positive. As a coach or a teacher or a consultant for these athletes, everything has to be done for a reason, and you have to convince them that this is the best thing that could have happened at this moment.
In 1980, you made the team, boycotted. 84 didn't quite qualify. It was very close. Yep. And Go Swim comes, you know, sometime later.
Yeah.
In the meantime, and I can imagine, you know, when you look back, this is only myself as an observer. So correct me where I go wrong here. But it seems like with, you know, your early experiences as a youth, what inspired you, and then your experiences in 1980, 84, really kind of propelled you to create this amazing swim platform with hundreds of thousands of users. What do you tell someone now who might, you know, not be able to go to Tokyo for something they've prepared, you know, 4 years for, but the Go Swim for you came much, much later. But for someone who's focused, you know, in the moment, it's supposed to be next year and now it's canceled. What's your kind of your wisdom or your teaching in that regard?
So I get a lot of questions from coaches, what they should do right now. We have teams that are working their athletes very hard and we're wondering for what. We don't know when the next competition is. So the way that I try to put it into terms for people is that this is a skill sport. You have to hone the skill. And the best sport that there's a couple sports. I actually worked with a boxer named Charles Conwell back in Cleveland that I think is about 10-0 right now. And I had Charles come out to the team and I say, what happens when you make a mistake in your sport? And he said, I get hit really hard. So I said to the swimmers, I said, what happens when you make a mistake in your sport? And they said, we get yelled at. And I said, no, that's not what I mean. If you make a mistake in swimming, you either become less efficient or go slower. And you won't know that you've made that mistake unless you're aware of everything that you're doing. And so we have to make them aware. So building the skill becomes very important. So along the same lines as boxing, what I tell coaches right now is that if I wanted to learn martial arts for self-defense, if I wanted to learn how to disarm someone with a knife or a gun, and I started studying today, do I have any idea when I'm going to use that? The answer is no. I have no idea when I would need to use that, but let's hope never, but at some point, if I had to use it, it would be great if I knew all of the steps. And they were so instinctual that I didn't have to think about it. It just happened.
Right.
So we have to take our athletes right now and hone those steps and polish the form. Because this is an opportunity for athletes, in my opinion, because we don't know when the next competition is. And if you overprepare physically too early, you might not be able to hold it long enough, that peak conditioning. Right. So honing the skill right now means it's a little bit less physical. It's always physical, but it's a little bit less physical. It's more like, yoga in the water, where you're honing this form to slide through the water perfectly. Will you need to use that someday? Absolutely. Will you perform better if you know it? Absolutely. Will you perform worse if you don't? Absolutely. So it's a great opportunity to take an advantage of a time where you can hone skills rather than just try to get in shape.
And so you're drawing it back, it sounds like, in a way to process and something process. That they can. Yeah, okay.
Okay. Especially the triathletes I work with. The triathletes, competitive athletics is a very short lifespan, and you're always under pressure to perform at a certain stage. Right now, with this delay, this gives the triathletes almost a full another 4 to 6 months of nothing but process learning, so that when they come out on the other side, because they're still biking, they're still running, so they're fit, but now they don't know that they have all this pressure about having to swim as fast as what they need to, so they can reset those skills. So you have to look in these strangest times, what can I do that will be the biggest positive? How can I use this time to be the biggest positive rather than just continuing the grind? What can I learn that I will need later?
There's great lessons here, well outside of sports as well. It's take the time seeing it as an opportunity, and that's a good way to look at things. You have an interesting quote on Swimming World magazine. And this is the quote, and there's one word that sticks out that I wanted to ask you about, because it doesn't, at first glance, it doesn't seem to match. We're really trying to ask what are people's definition of excellence? What are their values and focuses? What is their day-to-day of achieving it does? And are their goals being actually achieved? And the word so there's three key words there, excellence, values, and focuses. And the one that seems like it might be a little bit different is values. And so you're working with a person's excellence, their focal points, those things, they make sense just as at a glance. But I'm wondering if you can talk about the values piece, which feels different in a way.
It can be, and at the same time not. There's integrity of work. And, there's an honesty in work. I have people all the time who write online and say, can you help me with this? Can you, can you give me a workout? Can you do this? And I say, well, without knowing you, without being right in front of me, I really can't give you any advice. I don't know how hard you work. I work really hard. Honest, I do. I have no idea of knowing that unless I see it, so we think that, and Rachel and I talk about this all the time, that developing the person and developing and finding the people that have the value of understanding the work and the honesty of work and not lying to yourself saying that I really worked hard today. You know whether or not you did. You know whether or not you actually streamlined off every wall and were honest about how many dolphin kicks you took and was your breakout proper. There's an honesty and a value of the work. And if you don't have the values to understand and appreciate that work, then there's something missing. You'll never reach your potential without what we consider the values, and the values of honesty, integrity, consistency. And it's those things that will carry you on after the sport is done, that if those values are consistent in you, then we've also done what we feel is a far more important job than making people fast, but helping develop people that will be a positive impact on the world. Because you're only going to be an athlete for this long. So we want to make sure that the people we work with understand the value of everything we do in the pool to reach your best, so that they carry that outside the pool and, hopefully create a better society.
There's something else here about self-awareness that I wanted to ask you about, and going back to the spark that ignited you with your brother, a question that jumps out is, would it have been, if you were turned, awake in some way, would it have been possible to have that realization without going through that experience? And if so, how might you pass that on to someone else then, without having to go through that, enduring the selected pain and not the forced pain?
Yeah. We had spoken about that briefly.
Yeah.
I, I got to watch my brother hop down the hall to go to the bathroom because he only had one leg.
Yeah.
And then go with him to the hospital when he was getting chemotherapy. And so what I call forced pain is the idea of people that are sick or ill or injured, that you don't have a choice whether or not you're going to go through this pain. This is going to be on you whether you like it or not. And from personal witnessing of how he dealt with it, and another great friend, Dave Denniston, who's the head coach of the University of Wyoming, who was the first person I ever filmed for Go Swim. Dave was in an accident in 2005 after missing the Olympic team in 2004 by two places. He was in an accident, is paralyzed from the waist down, and has become just one of the most inspirational people that I've ever met. So he went through forced pain and came out of the other side an incredible, incredible person. So as an athlete, if you go to the pool and you have what's called selected pain, you decide how much you're going to hurt that day. And you decide, well, this is a little bit too much. For me, what I witnessed, I can't complain about being a little sore when my brother had to hop down the hallway just to go to the bathroom. So perspective is very important in those things as well. And understanding, you know, I mean, it basically breaks down to as basic as you have to stop feeling sorry for yourself at some point and just get back to work. And I know that that's not very popular these days. But we have, that's where this goes back to the values, that you have to be honest with yourself. Is this really that bad? Great interview just 2 days ago on the American Swim Coaches Association with a good friend, Javon Walters, who's a swim coach in Detroit. So here's this guy that we've known as a swim coach for a while, and then he gives his interview, and we realize he works 40 hours a week on the Chrysler assembly line. And then after that, goes and coaches. So wow. Before and after work at Chrysler, he's coaching. And so how bad do you really have it when all you do is coach? So it's all about perspective and understanding what other people go through to decide whether or not you should be complaining about something. And right now, there's not a lot of complaining that can be done, on this side of the fence. So, you know, life perspective is very important as well.
How can we gain that? Or when you work with an athlete, how might you foster that kind of gaining a perspective?
Well, it's certainly in the world, the changing world that we live in right now, we have to learn as much from the athletes as we tell, mm-hmm. because it's a whole new world. We need to learn so much about what we've done wrong and how we gain more perspective to help them out. So there has to be, in order to be, I think, a great teacher or a great coach or a great business person, I could be wrong about that one. I'm not that great at that. That's why I have business partners. But there has to be a humility in your approach to things. You can't go in just saying you're going to do this because I say so. There has to be working together. And as a coach, you're pretty much put into a position that whatever you say goes. It's not really like that anymore. There has to be a partnership between the athlete and the coach. And the coach has to learn what inspires that athlete, what motivates that athlete, and then what are the things that that athlete needs help with, and what don't I know about the background of that athlete that will make me communicate with them better, make us a better team, make them a better athlete. So we're in a very new time that obviously should have been going on for a long time, as far as building the awareness of other people first.
I suppose bringing in the boxer, as I reflect on this, was an example of bringing perspective of just someone from a completely different sport.
Yeah, and a completely different background. Charles was a 17-year-old African-American from Cleveland, Ohio, when mm-hmm. he went to Rio at the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm in my mid-50s, white guy, you know, but we came together on an understanding of athletics. Athletics is so beautiful on some of these things. One of the stories I like to tell is that when we were living in New York City, we had Omar and Amro El-Ghazari, two Egyptian pentathletes that ended up in New York City, and they were going to swim on Rachel's team at Asphalt Green on the Upper East Side. Only we realized that they didn't have a place to stay. So we had a one-bedroom apartment in New York City that Amro and they stayed in. They slept on our floor, Omar and Amro. They slept on the floor in our apartment in the living room. And they had, if you know pentathletes, they have more equipment than anybody in the world.
Oh, okay.
These massive bags, because they've got their horse stuff and their sabers, and you know, there wasn't much room. The real story behind this is that there were two Muslim guys from Egypt sleeping in a Jewish female's apartment, and it was all about athletics.
Right.
Athletics usurps a lot of the problems that we have, and that's one of the reasons we love it so much, is that it doesn't matter where the other person is, what they believe, what anything. It's about the process of learning and helping them become the best that they can be. And I think if people don't see athletics like that, then maybe it was the boycott that really got me thinking that way from so many years ago. Mm-hmm. That, you know, had we brought all the kids together back then, maybe the world would be better. But if you don't see athletics as as just a sport, and you have to help everyone do that sport as best as possible, then you shouldn't be involved in it, because you've got ulterior motives, my opinion.
That's a good statement today, with all the, you know, racial stuff that's going on, you know, especially in the United States, but it's everywhere. But the Olympics are a unifying factor. It's one of the largest gatherings of young people in the world. And although it's too bad it didn't happen this year, I mean, we all look, there's a reason everyone looks forward to the Olympics when it comes around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go Swim has, you've got an endless pool in your back, in your backyard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Go Swim has been very innovative. There's an app called Deck Shots, where you can immediately upload the video and give some feedback and stuff like that. And some of the stuff you've done is, I just can't get over it. And so I wanted to have a quick look at someone, an elite swimmer here, see his technique and see him going here. And this is, I'll turn the audio off here, but he's one of the top swimmers in the world, right?
And for his age and weight class.
And this is so cool. This is in your backyard, I believe. And this is, showed earlier with the shade. And so you've got the video going, and you've got the mirror in the bottom. And so it's really about, you can see yourself. You can see there, you're looking at yourself and evaluating your own technique. And it just is a statement about, there is a world-class breaststroke.
There you go.
There.
Now you're talking.
So innovative and so, you know, cutting edge, and you've talked about how much you can use this in different kind of ways in how you teach. And so how do you view like innovation, creativity, working with people in different ways? What's your take on that?
We're being besieged with data right now, and data is dry, in my opinion. And the problem is that the actions of an athlete are flowing and need to be experienced, rather than, it's like the old Rocky movie. It's a difference between Drago with all the science and everything, and then Rocky just going out climbing, carrying logs. We have to find a good middle ground, because we don't want to overload people with the static nature of athletics. We want the flow to continue to occur. So there has to be a way to get data in mass to show people trends, to show what their trends are over time and whether or not they're improving or not improving. So we're taking our first foray into this in the next couple months. We've been working on an app for a while that will gather some data from an Apple Watch. We're just going to start with the Apple Watch. And what that data is going to show us is it'll give us an efficiency of that swimmer, which then goes back into the video library and says, out of the 3,000 some videos that we've created, these are the ones that we think are going to be the best ones for you to learn improvement on. And so as we get better at honing the data, from a consumer product, then we'll get better at delivering the right videos using some AI, that, you know, there's a bunch of great companies out there using AI. And so our goal from a technology perspective is to personalize the experience for the individual and give them a path towards improvement that they can do on their own. Now, this app is going to be more targeted to triathletes, masters, fitness swimmers, but I'm in the process of, we've created, almost 200 new videos just for this particular thing, but then it also ties into the existing library. So we've worked on some pretty cool stuff with some different companies, like Finice has a product that they've been working on called Lane Vision, where it does a lot of this data acquisition just through the visual nature of the phone, so the optics of the phone. So technology is definitely, you have to embrace it or else, you know, it'll pass you by. So, you know, look at what the great technology companies are doing. And every day we sit down and say, how can we harness this? And then you have to balance it with being a, you know, the size of your business with how much investment is required to make certain things happen. So, but those decisions are made, you know, as frequently as possible.
Wow. That is, and you know, and I'm not involved in your sport as you are, but those things seem really cutting edge. And I can't wait to see kind of what comes of it. When would the app, you know, the application, all those things be released?
We're looking at early August. So we're looking at 3 to 4 weeks away. We're doing some final. Yeah.
These are exciting times.
And scary.
Well, that means it's worth it.
That's right.
And your business partner, Barbara Hummel, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, yeah. who works with, you know, co-founded GoSwim.tv yeah. with you. She brought a lot of good ideas. And you've said in the past that without her, GoSwim, with neither of you, it wouldn't be the same. But without her from yeah. the business perspective, it might not be what it is today. And so what are some of the things that she's been able to do that's helped you to really grow and improve?
First of all, she does all the legal, she does all the accounting, she does all of the hard stuff that I don't do. She makes decisions on, you know, we have a development partner as well. And so he and I will go crazy on what we want to do. And then it's you know, we have to justify everything to Barbara because she's not as technologically savvy as we are. And so she keeps us in check because if it doesn't make sense to her, it's probably not a good product. So Barbara also was lead editor of a company called St. Martin's Press out of New York City. So she's taught me how to write. She's taught me how to communicate. She's helped me help her do less on that side of things because, you know, when you create something, if you write an article or you write a script for a video and you're so proud of it, and if you give it to an editor for the first time and it comes back completely different, redlined, and you just look at it and you just go, you're offended. I mean, you're like, this was the greatest thing I ever did in my life. How could this be? That she sees it totally differently.
Yeah.
And over a couple of years, you're like, wow, okay, well, I can't send this out before Barbara sees it or else I'm going to look like an idiot. And so she's helped me so much from that end of that side of it that I've become better at making her do less work. But she's been a true friend and a great partner for a long, long time. And, you know, it's again, it's dividing the tasks up. She doesn't tell me how to film. She doesn't tell me how to create the things. She helps me polish them on certain things to make them better. I don't tell her, you know, what a contract should say or whether or not we should pay our taxes. You know, she takes care of all that stuff. So it's been a great partnership because we don't necessarily do the same thing. But she is a great coach, swam in Olympic trials twice as an age grouper and, you know, has a deep understanding of the sport. So, again, if I can make sense to her, then I know we're on the right track.
That's awesome. Complimentary strengths and such yeah. Such a good partnership with hundreds of thousands yeah. of users, which is incredible. So my last question here is, I'm wondering if you can tell us a story, and I'm going to give you two words and one phrase. Okay. Grandmother, Ferrari, and President of the United States. And I'm wondering if we can hear this is such a hilarious story. And I just had to ask you to tell it.
That is too funny. So I think 14 years old, 1976, watching the Olympics. This was before everything really hit. So we're watching the Olympics and I watched the 200 breaststroke in Montreal. And I see David Wilkie win the Olympics and Grandma was there. And I said, I'm going to do that someday. And she goes, boy, I tell you what, if you do that, I'll buy you a Ferrari. So I'm like, oh, okay. So obviously things kind of progressed to the point where it looked pretty, there's a big possibility that it could happen. And so the way I like to tell it is that when Jimmy Carter was going through the process of whether or not we were going to boycott, all I could picture was my grandma on the phone to him saying, you can't let him go. He's got a shot of winning. I got to buy him a Ferrari. So my grandmother, I think, was lobbying against me going at that point. But that's the way I like to remember it.
Still your biggest fan. Okay.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So I'll just wrap this up. Stay on with me afterwards here. But Glenn, this has been such a pleasure. Really, it has been. And we wish you all the best on your journey with USA Swimming and all the folks at GoSwim.tv and Rachel and Barbara and everyone that you're walking and swimming that journey with. It's been so great talking to you.
Thank you so much, Darwin.
What phenomenal stories from Glenn Mills. Great talk. I enjoyed it so very much. His insights that really, if we fully commit ourselves to something, we can get further than if we didn't, and we give ourselves the best chance of success. And he really lived that, and so much respect for what he's achieved in life. I chuckled, but also enjoyed how he dealt with working with multiple legendary swimmers, Elson Schmidt, Michael Phelps, so reflective and so wise. And he works with them as a partnership. That being a cornerstone of the relationship and not telling. And Allison Schmidt's response that no one had ever not given her advice. Just really good, solid stuff there. His insights on the development of awareness and teaching his athletes to be independent and successful in life after swimming as well. Great lessons there and just so good. And you can see that he's just a very effective coach and teacher as he thinks of it. I love his phrase, you have to stop feeling sorry for yourself at some point and just get back to work. Just roll up the sleeves and hammer at it. And we have to get 1% better every day. And whether you're elite athlete or in business or just life in general, coaches can help us. And I've worked with people from all gamuts of life, world champions, business people, moms, dads, entrepreneurs, students, and I've experienced the benefits of coaching myself and wanted to give back. And that's what triggered me to get into the field. So if you'd like to find out more, please check out evolutionofleaders.com. Reach out to me. I'd love to hear from you. If you enjoyed this, please like, subscribe, and share. Thank you so much.